May it please the Court.
Mr. Lehrman.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Mike Lehrman, a senior law student in Northwestern's Bloom Legal Clinic, and I represent Roderick Sinclair in this criminal appeal. Sinclair's conviction should be reversed because the district court denied him his constitutionally protected right to choice of counsel. At a minimum, this court should remand for resentencing because the district court made a legal error in interpreting and applying the guidelines. I want to just make a couple quick points on sentencing, first of all. The district court mixed and matched the guideline for grouping with the application note for the guideline regarding mandatory minimum sentences. This was erroneous, and it increased Sinclair's guideline range. And it's not just that it was erroneous, it also is counter to all precedent. In our briefing, we've identified three circuits who have examined this specific question. They've all come out on Sinclair's side on this argument. Furthermore, there's never been a court that has endorsed the government's position with regards to the application note interpretation here.
Actually, I thought there was just the one reported Court of Appeals case that is on all fours here that went your way.
Your Honor, you're right. In terms of, I believe you're referring to the Bell case.
Right.
The Bell case is on all fours with this question. The other two cases that we cited from the 6th and 11th circuits recognize, while not holding, recognize that grouping would be appropriate in this set of charges. Moving on to the sentence, the choice of counsel issue.
Well, as respects Bell, the court there didn't really discuss or deal with in any way the application note explanation.
Your Honor, could you be...
The district court judge did in this case in interpreting and applying the guidelines in this situation. In other words, that the offense characteristic enhancement isn't applicable here, and so the grouping rule doesn't apply.
You're referring to the application note 5 to 3D1.2 or...
Yes.
Application note 4 to the mandatory minimum.
Well, both. The district court referred to both here and concluded that they both take this case outside the general grouping rules because the offense characteristic in the parallel offenses here isn't being used to enhance the range for the other offense.
Well, you're correct, Your Honor, in characterizing the district court's interpretation of the guideline. It's our argument that the interpretation that application note 5 to the mandatory minimum sentence, because it prevents the use of an enhancement in a specific case, that does not change the way enhancements are treated for the general purposes of the grouping statute. No court has ever held that.
We're required to pay attention to that application note to the extent that it describes a situation that applies here, and I think it does.
Well, Your Honor, with respect to the application note 5 to the mandatory minimum sentence, that is an application note to an entirely different portion of the guidelines than the grouping guidelines, which was the grouping was denied to Sinclair in this case. It, frankly, application note 5 doesn't apply to the grouping statute. It applies to the to section 2K2.4.
Then why does it appear in the grouping guideline if it doesn't have anything to do with it? Did the Sentencing Commission just make a mistake?
Your Honor, I'm confused by your question.
This is an application of 5 to 3D1.2 explains a situation in which that guideline does not apply.
Right. The invocation of 3D1.2 by the district court and by the government muddies the issue somewhat here, Your Honor. 3D1.2 describes a factual situation that is not present here, which is grouping for the purposes of conduct that arises out of the same act or circumstances. What we're talking about here is grouping for the purposes of conduct that serve as enhancements for each other. And that's what the erroneous decision was on the district court's by the district court.
That's the circumstance under which a count is grouped. That's the only one that applies. This is a subsection C of 3D1.2 case. The only way that there would be grouping here is if one of the counts embodies conduct that is treated as a specific offense characteristic that results in an enhancement or adjustment.
That's right, Your Honor.
And the application note 5 takes this one out because the counts aren't being used to enhance one another.
Your Honor,
we don't have a double counting problem.
Right. So you've stated the district court's opinion, district court's finding, which is that because in this specific case,
right,
the application note to the mandatory minimum sentence was used to prevent the enhancements from being employed, then that would deny grouping. But that requires a finding that under those circumstances, there would never be a criminal defendant who could get the benefit of grouping under these combination of charges, which is an absurd result. Furthermore, under that scenario, the defendants would be forced to wait until a hearing to decide, to see what the district judge, what enhancement that district judge was indeed going to apply before it would know whether or not their charges were going to be grouped. And therefore, I don't think so.
An authoritative ruling from this court would settle the matter, and everybody would know that with this combination of charges, which is common, would not be grouped.
And so common that, as the Bell Court noted, they are grouped often without note. If I could move on to the choice of counsel issue, it equally merits reversal. Here there are two threshold facts that are unique among all cases that have come before this court and weigh heavily in Sinclair's favor. First of all, the district court made a clear error of law when it applied ineffective assistance principles in denying Sinclair's request for new choice of counsel. This error was a per se abuse of discretion because the court was required to balance not ineffective assistance, but rather Sinclair's constitutional right to choice of counsel. Significantly, the court made 11 separate references to ineffective assistance, often referring to it as a salient right. In fact, at one point, the district court made the statement that the strongest factor in favor of granting Sinclair's continuance request was that he was not being provided effective assistance of counsel. That was not the strongest factor in favor of Sinclair's continuance request. The strongest factor is that he was invoking his right to choose his own attorney.
But he was doing so on the eve of trial and under circumstances in which it was completely unclear about whether he was going to be able to retain his own counsel, and certainly not in time for the trial, which was starting the next day.
2 points, Your Honor. First, on the timeliness issue. Sinclair wrote his letter on February 1st. The district court received it on February 2nd, which was a full 5 days before trial started. That's well within the time that this court has found was a reasonable amount of time to request new counsel under Carlson and Sellers. Now, with regards to your point as to the certainty of retaining counsel, Sinclair had told the court, and the court was aware that Sinclair's family was waiting on the return of a tax return to pay for the counsel. The court knew that that return was coming from the United States Treasury. The court knew that the defendant's family had spoken with the criminal defense attorney and that it would cover the cost of
that
attorney.
These were the representations that your client was making. There was no finding to that effect. He just accepted them at face value.
That's right. And, in fact, he also made the finding that Sinclair was making his request in good faith. And that this court must credit that his request in good faith.
Right. That doesn't make the circumstances any less contingent or speculative, and that's the material point here, is that this was highly contingent, highly speculative, even accepting everything your client was saying at face value and ascribing him with good faith motives instead of dilatory motives. It was highly contingent, and that's, as I read the transcript, what the district court judge was concerned about. You know, he's got this jury coming in. The witnesses are all under subpoena. The
Your
case
Honor.
Is scheduled for trial. There isn't anything wrong with the relationship between the defendant and his current counsel that is going to raise a Sixth Amendment Strickland problem, and that's the only context under which the court was discussing Strickland, not because the judge misunderstood the right in question.
Well, Your Honor, with regards to your question on the breakdown in relationship, I'd like to briefly respond and then conclude for rebuttal. Roderick Sinclair said on the record that he had no intention of going to trial today with Stevens as his federal defender. This was in front of the court. Roderick Sinclair's intention was clear, at least it should have been clear to the district court. With that, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Lehrman. Ms. Kremenz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Emily Kremenz on behalf of the United States. The district court has wide latitude to determine whether or not to grant a continuance to allow a defendant to retain counsel of choice. And here, the district court acted within its discretion when it denied that continuance. As the panel has noted, Mr. Sinclair did not, in fact, have an attorney with him when he was seeking the continuance. And the court noted, it's on page 17 of the appendix attached to the brief of the appellant, that the court thought it was uncertain as to whether or not Mr. Sinclair would, in fact, hire Mr. Ligno, and whether that allowing a continuance would essentially require the district court to bet on the future. And although Mr. Sinclair tries to cast the transcript in the light that the district court was confused about which standard to apply, that is not the case. And that comes out through a reading of the transcript. The district court started its analysis when it addressed Mr. Sinclair about his request to gather more information for the reasons behind Mr. Sinclair's request. It then noted the timeliness of the request and the fact that it was uncertain that Mr. Sinclair would, in fact, hire another attorney. The district court noted the length of the trial. It noticed the inconvenience to the people involved, including the 34 individuals who are going to be part of the jury veneer, the six witnesses that the government was going to call, five of whom were under subpoena. And also then the district court examined each of the three reasons that Mr. Sinclair had given to support his request for continuance and found, in fact, that one of those did weigh in Mr. Sinclair's favor, as opposing counsel has noted, yet it determined that in the exercise of its discretion, it did not believe that a continuance was warranted in this situation. And that is precisely what this court has asked district courts to do. They are to balance the concerns of the defendant and the defendant's rights against the inconvenience to the parties, the court's own calendar, and the transcript shows that the district court did that both at the...
Were the government's witnesses there?
There were two separate inquiries, I guess. The first was on Monday, February 6th, and at that point in time, the government witnesses were not there because trial was set to start the next day. But then they were there when Mr. Sinclair raised the issue again on Tuesday, February 7th, the morning of trial.
On the first occasion that the request came in, there were no witnesses there.
That is correct, yes. The request, the record indicates that the district court received the request on the Thursday prior to trial. The hearing on the request was set on Friday for the following Monday, and there were no witnesses present at that time. Looking also at February 7th, the district court again engaged in that discretionary balancing analysis, this time with different facts from the Monday hearing. At this point, Mr. Sinclair noted that the money had come in to hire Mr. Ligno, yet he had not been able to do that. Mr. Ligno was unable to return his phone calls, so as the district court noted, the district court knew that Mr. Ligno was unavailable, and at the same time, it was the day of trial, and the attorney that Mr. Sinclair wanted could not be there. So there was essentially no counsel of choice available. It was not an abuse of discretion for the district court to consider that, as well as the other factors, the fact that now the government witnesses were present, the 34 veneer members were present, the parties were ready to proceed, and there had been no breakdown in the relationship between Mr. Sinclair and his court-appointed attorney to result in an abuse of discretion to deny the continuance. The government would also ask this court to affirm the district court's finding that the counts should not have grouped for purposes of sentencing. Application note, well, I guess the relevant guideline at this point is section 3D1.2 and specifically subsection C, which is the provision that Mr. Sinclair relies on to argue in favor of grouping. And application note 5, which to section 3D1.2, which specifically addresses the subsection C, lays out a factual example and says that you look at the specific facts of the counts of conviction to determine whether or not 3D1.2C applies. And here, 3D1.2C does not apply because the specific offense enhancements that incorporated both the felon in possession count and the possession with intent to distribute count, whichever way you look at it, were not applied as a result of the count two, which was the mandatory minimum 5-year consecutive sentence because Mr. Sinclair used a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking crime. So we believe that, you know, this, as the district court noted, this is an open question as insofar as the guidelines are concerned. And we recognize that the Eighth Circuit has held that the counts do group, yet as Judge Sykes noted, they did not address Application Note 5 and the specific example given in that application note. And the government believes that that example and that application note suggest that the district court did not err in this instance when it found that the counts should not group. If there are no further questions from the panel, I will cede the rest of my time and just ask that the district or that this panel affirm the convictions and sentence. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Lehrman?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your time is almost up, but we'll give you at least one full minute.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I want to make two quick points. First of all, the right to choice of counsel is a right to a fair opportunity to choice of counsel. No court has ever held that it's a prerequisite that a criminal defendant actually retain that counsel in order for them to invoke their right to choice of counsel. Really, that's putting the cart before the horse. In fact, you must choose someone before you are able to retain them. Furthermore, one of the factors that courts examine when
is it a bit hard, even in principle, to say that this defendant was deprived of his right to the services of Mr. Lenio when Mr. Lenio has never in the entire history of the world agreed to represent him?
Well, Your Honor, it's about his choice. It's about his fair opportunity to obtain the counsel of his choice. It's not about whether or not Lenio actually joined the case. Furthermore, one of the factors that this court examines is the likelihood of retention. That factor alone counsels towards the suggestion that it need not be a prerequisite that counsel be obtained prior to going to trial. The other thing I want to talk about briefly is that here we have a unique circumstance where we have an explicit finding of good faith by the district court, which never happens. Usually it happens in a way that dings the defendant. It says this is a bad faith request. So does
your position imply that if moments before a trial starts, the defendant says, I want a continuance because I want to engage, and then here insert Ted Olson or some other famous lawyer. I'm sure Ted Olson will do a better job than my public defender. It's true he hasn't agreed to represent me, but I want time to talk to him, see if I can scrape together enough money. Right? On your view, the Constitution requires the judge to say, okay, everybody in this courtroom is prepared to go to trial. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, pardon us, go home. All you witnesses, go home.
Well, Your Honor,
pie in the sky takes precedent over actually running a courtroom.
Your Honor, that factual scenario is not what occurred here.
For all we know, it was entirely pie in the sky. Mark Lenio never said that he would represent Mr. Sinclair. Never.
Your Honor, that's correct from the record, but we also know that his family had spoken with Mr. Lenio. And the factual scenario you laid out is not the factual scenario here. Sinclair wrote a letter from jail on February 1st. The district court got that on February 2nd. So it is not on the eve of trial. In fact, it's well within the timeliness of this court's precedent. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you. We just ask that you reverse Sinclair's conviction or at a minimum remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lehrman. We appreciate your willingness and that of the clinic at Northwestern to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement.